Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
They don't have trust. They don't trust each other. You can't trust each other if you don't have a community. A community comes first. Once you get a community and you get to know people, then you move up to the next level, you trust them. Once you learn how to trust people, then you move up to the third level, you begin to cooperate with them. And once you learn how to cooperate with them, then you get to the fourth level, you start holding them accountable for what they're doing wrong. The same thing in business. In business, you're building a business operation, and competitiveness and power dynamics is a five-story building. The first thing you all should be doing, as I said, get you some institutions like the chamber and started teaching, acquiring wealth and power through operating businesses. If you build an economy, that's a five-story building. The first floor must always be economics. Always build an economy before you do everything else. The first floor is the economy. The second floor is politics. The third floor is the court and police departments, the enforcement system. The fourth floor is the media. The fifth floor is schools. Now, again, you've been bamboozled on that because they keep telling you that you go send black folks to school, jump to the fifth floor, and try to come back down. Education can't do nothing. Education is just a tool. You start with your economy. Once you build an economy, a viable, competitive economy, by making your money circulate 8 to 12 times, you take that money and you move to the second floor. The second floor is your politicians. Don't worry about voting. You don't have to vote. People that got money, whether it's organized crime or wealthy people, they don't have to vote. You take your money on the first floor and you buy every politician on the second floor. And if you can't buy them, you rent or lease them. And once you rent or lease those politicians or buy them on the second floor, you make hold them accountable to go to the third floor. And you stop the police from shooting and killing black folk all the time and come up with new codes of conduct. Then once you get to the third floor and get the police and court system straight because you can now effectuate it, then you go to the fourth floor. The fourth floor means media. You cannot own television stations, radio stations, and daily newspapers if you don't have an economy. I hear black folk crying all the time. I have two radio stations. I used to have four. You cannot have a media operation unless you have an economy. Who's going to buy your time, your ads? You got to have an economy to buy the time. And so you got it. Right now we have 12,000 radio stations in the United States. We got about 12,000 cable systems, 5,000 daily newspapers, 5,000 TV stations. Black folk own 0.35%. You can't even communicate. You can't communicate, you can't organize. You can't get communication because you don't have an economy. And once you get enough money, you put your medium up at the fourth floor. Then lastly, you tell the fifth floor, which is a school system, say, here's what we want. We don't want any more black basketball players or football players. Every black right now, a successful black, has got some kind of an illicit relationship with a ball. He's either running with a tennis ball, basketball, golf ball, football, sitting on jokes, telling jokes, pretending he's having a ball. Just get away from that. And say, from now on, you've got to raise kids that can produce something. The producers will be the people survive. Right now, black folk are zero producers and 100% consumers. You're going to get totally wiped out in this country and wiped off the face of the earth under globalization if you don't learn how to produce vertically. You produce something at the bottom level, then you go up and have other blacks come in over you. Like I'm producing fish, 1 million pounds of fish a year, I want blacks to come in and warehouse, wholesale, distributor, then retail. I want to see some black lobster restaurants in the country. And you build, and I have about two more minutes I got. Now, and you build these vertical orders based on your competitive advantages. Start build your businesses where you have a competitive advantage. What are your competitive advantages, black folk? Always build your business where you dominate in population or you dominate in spending patterns. I built the seafood factories. Why? Because blacks eat 3 to 4 times more seafood than whites, and you spend $9 for every $1 white spend. You should be controlling the seafood industry. Do the same thing with leather. You do the same thing with your hair. Right now, blacks are the only people that got a certain quality of hair, and yet the Koreans are controlling black hair care in America. And you want to build these businesses like the difference between Detroit and Chinatown. You got it in Chinatown in New York. In Chinatown, New York, they got about a little less than 300,000 Chinese there. And again, in Detroit, you got almost 1 million blacks. I looked at the two and compared them. What in Chinatown, they had 35 banks, 35 Asian banks. Detroit, they got two black banks, and that's owned by the same one. How is it almost 1 million people don't have two banks and 300,000 have 35 banks? I looked at the number of restaurants. The Asians had almost 400-some restaurants in New York. Black folks in Detroit had three. I looked at and I said, how do these Asians producing so well and have so much, and they got, and Asians have the highest median family income in America. Here's what they do in conclusion. They build around their advantage. What is it that Asians eat most of? They eat noodles. I went and found something like about 100 and some noodle factories in New York where they produce their own noodles. Now, once they produce the noodles, what do you put on the noodles? They put a sauce on the noodles. I found about another 60 or 70 companies that produce a sauce to go on the noodles. And I said, what else are they producing? Then when I found that they had, I don't know how many, 35 or 40 companies that make the little fortune cookies. They take care of their own people. That's why you never see Asians, Arabs, Hispanic, or American Indians out marching for integration or for social civil rights. They don't do it. They build businesses. I love you all. Take care.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems, so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
My home is not for sale, and if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salit is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse.
But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home, and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salida are refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salidas out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salidas are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this. And paid it off, and we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired, and now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salidas home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salidas neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums with great views over the Rocky River. Those condos will be a cinch to sell.
But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Salidas and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area and how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted. It is a legal statutory term
meaning
that is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use.
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
3 bedrooms, 2 baths, an attached 2-car garage, and central air. Now, this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have 3 bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. and it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air?
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie, the breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all seven council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have two bathrooms?
No.
Blight. Two-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or, I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute? Maybe. But without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Salites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks that property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa, citing the need for redevelopment, is trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not, you get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
The city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of 3 restaurants and 4 businesses that once stood on this 5-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out 8 people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out, but he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
The thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away, and from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
you can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a break-in front-end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Lenhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this, and he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense. But the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Lenhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth, and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else, when I own the land, is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times.
It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead, but the Salids plus a dozen others are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving to the ballot box. Lakewood residents opposed to the development have gathered enough signatures to force a citywide referendum on it come November.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I didn't have nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit, so I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it, I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, I wanted to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I called him back Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I called Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the 6th floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you, don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the 6th floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there, another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken didn't wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was, they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened.
The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord.
And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
Montanus Ratanapakti is grieving for her father, an always gentle soul.
Happy birthday, dear grandpa.
Her dad, Vichar, moved from Thailand to San Francisco to help his daughter and son-in-law, Eric, take care of their two sons. It wasn't long before the whole neighborhood fell in love with grandpa.
Grandpa always spoiling all the neighbor. Grandpa always teaching us about forgiveness. All the neighbor remember him, and he's smiling.
But this is the video no daughter wants to see. Surveillance cameras capturing the moment her 84-year-old dad was attacked and violently knocked to the ground on a morning walk.
It's a painful. I don't want to see it. It's a broken heart.
Vichar died 2 days later in the hospital.
He never wake up again, bleeding on his brain.
What did you say to him when you got to see him in the hospital?
Dad, wake up. I want him to stay alive and wake up and come and see me again. But he never wake up again. And I pray for him.
The Thai immigrant's death, one of a slew of assaults against elderly Asian Americans in Northern California, Drawing the spotlight after celebrities like Daniel Wu and Daniel Dae Kim brought star power and a $25,000 reward.
It was a very visceral response. I got very angry because I thought, this is now a year of these kinds of things going on.
The videos prompting more than 1,000 people to gather over the weekend in the Bay Area to speak out against anti-Asian violence, calling for racial justice. Police arrested a 19-year-old suspect who pled not guilty to murder and elderly abuse. His lawyer saying his client had no knowledge of Mr. Ratanapakti's race, since his face was fully covered with a mask and hat, and insists the attack wasn't racially motivated and instead had to do with a break in the mental health of a teenager. Even though no hate crime charges were filed, some in the community blame the tension between black people and Asian Americans.
I think they targeting to the Asian American community.
We need the black community to realize that that black people are hurting Asians, and they need to speak out in their own community.
It is not just a black and Asian issue. It is something in the psyche of this country where somehow it's okay to abuse, physically or verbally abuse, Asian Americans. We're being scapegoated.
How do you try to distinguish between, you know, crimes of opportunity, crimes of just simple rage versus racism?
You know, we can talk about all the nuances, but this is not just one community. It is every community. We have the tech CEO in the Silicon Valley who verbally abused an Asian family in a restaurant.
Asian piece of
Oh my God.
And then we have Torrance Karen.
Go back to whatever Asian country you belong in.
Thank you for coming through.
Community leader Dr. Connie Wan says it's clear Asians are being scapegoated and blamed for the pandemic.
When the previous administration said things publicly, like the Wuhan virus,
the China flu,
the China virus, the plague from China, we have to be accurate.
Unapologetically, he helped to stoke the fires of anti-Asian violence against our communities.
Stop AAPI Hate began collecting more than 2,800 reports nationwide of anti-Asian hate between March and December. The NYPD reporting a nearly 2,000% increase in Asian American hate crimes last year. But Dr. Wan says these accounts are merely the tip of the iceberg.
Our communities are not reporting these incidences. We don't want to cause more trouble, more attention to our communities.
In this moment, with calls for racial justice echoing, a broader conversation is taking shape.
Historically, there have been tensions between the African American and Asian American communities, but George Floyd galvanized the two communities in a way that I'd never seen before. I've never seen more Asian Americans standing up in support of Black Lives Matter, myself included. And so I'm hoping that that momentum carries over into these cases, because it really ultimately is about a collective, unified response to injustice.
Historically, Black and Asian Americans have come into conflict in big cities, perhaps most dramatically during the unrest in Los Angeles following the Rodney King verdict.
A riot sparked by what was felt to be an unjust verdict for a black man also became an economic war against Koreans.
In what ways have blacks been pitted against Asians?
White America tends to privilege Asians and Asian Americans in ways that they do not our black and Latinx community members. So it is about the model minority myth, which is that our communities are excelling. Crazy Rich Asians, the Bling Empire.
More diamonds than her?
Treasure.
Those are not the real life depictions of what our communities really look like.
Just landed in San Francisco and I'm going to hit the ground running.
Will Lex Ham is part of the generation helping to move that momentum forward.
We're sick and tired of being invisible and ignored in our country. The pain of the Asian community has been muted for decades.
The actor flew from his home in New York to the Bay Area to spend the weekend in San Francisco's historic Chinatown. Handing out self-defense whistles. And passing out pamphlets in Chinese, informing people how to report hate crimes in their community. Ham also met with local leaders on the ground.
You don't fight racism with racism. You fight racism with solidarity.
And quickly realized
He has a lot to learn.
This is the Oakland anti-Asian racism violence rally. We're joined by our Black Brothers and Sisters.
Now, this is a call to action to everybody else who believes.
We keep us safe. We keep us safe.
Asian American history is American history that needs to be taught. And so when it came to the Bay Area, I first learned about all these incredible Asian Americans who've been doing the work for decades, and they're utilizing their relationships with, you know, Black community leaders, you know, and a lot of the solidarity work that has been happening here to condemn the violence, to condemn the anti-Asian hate crimes.
Activists are also looking towards lawmakers like New York Congresswoman Grace Meng. Last year, she passed a House resolution condemning anti-Asian hate speech.
I started to get voicemails.
I'm calling about the Karate Kid virus.
Hey, you look like a Chinese virus, you fat slob.
There was just so much hate. And even though I and so many Asian Americans were born and raised in the United States of America, there are always instances where we are made to feel that we are foreigners. It's like when you're shouting in the wilderness, our people are getting attacked, our people are getting harassed, spat on, beat up, you know, slashed. You know, please, somebody pay attention. Please, you know, notice us. Give me confirmation that, you know, I am American too. And I just haven't been able to feel that in a long time.
I know you have children. You know, I'm a mom too. What do you say to them?
I said, look, you know, this is what's going on. There are people in this country who will take a look at you and without knowing anything about you, may call you something that is derogatory, may even try to cause harm to you.
It strikes me that this is the Asian equivalent of the talk that African American parents often have to have with their children.
I've had, you know, very sort of superficial talks about, you know, understanding people's different racial background. It was really one of the first time that I, as a mom of two young boys, started to be scared for their life and what might happen to them in public.
That fear is something Montanus and Eric say their young sons, who already lost their grandfather so tragically, have had to deal with firsthand.
I've been outside with the kid, and then I've been attacked with a wobbly. They're yelling, and then you are sick. You are wireless Asian.
How did your kids react to that?
We know it's violence. We just walk away.
But that pain pales in comparison to her father's murder.
We want him to be the spark that starts the healing and the recognition of what's going on.
I miss him a lot every day. He's a caring person. You can't believe this happened.
Hi everyone, George Stephanopoulos here. Thanks for checking out the ABC News YouTube channel. If you'd like to get more videos, show highlights, and watch live event coverage, click on the right over here.
Yo, let's do this.
Nightmare walking, psychopath talking, king of my jungle, just a gangster stalking, living life like a firecracker, quick as my fuse, vendetta to death, that's the colors I choose, red or blue, cuz of blood, it just don't matter, sucker died for your life when my shotgun scattered, cuz the gangs of L.A. will never die, just multiply colors, cuz, you don't know me, fool. You disown me? Cool. I don't need your assistance. Social persistence. Any problem I got, I just put my fist in. My life is violent, but violence is life. Peace is a dream, reality is a night. My colors, my honor, my colors, my all. With my colors upon me, one soldier stands tall. Tell me, what have you left me? What have I got? Last night in cold blood, my young
young brother got shot. My homeboy got jacked. My mother's on crack. My sister can't work cause her arms show tracks. Madness, insanity, live in profanity. Then some punk claiming they're understanding me. Give me a break. What world do you live in? Death is my set. Guess my religion. My pants are sagging, braided hair. Suckers stare, but I don't care. My game ain't knowledge, my game fear. I've no remorse, so squares beware. But my two missions is just revenge. You ain't my set, you ain't my friend. Wear the wrong color, your life could end. Homicide's my favorite binge color. So I'll just walk like a giant, police defiant. You'll say to stop, but I'll say that I can't. My gang, my family, it's all that I have. I'm a star on the wall, my autograph. You don't like it, so you know where you can go. Suck the streets on my stage and tear at my show. Psychoanalyze, try diagnose me why. It wasn't your brother who brutally died, but it was mine, so let me define. My territory, don't cross the line. Don't try to act crazy, cause that shit don't faze me. If you ran like a punk, it wouldn't amaze me, cause my color's death. Though we all want peace, but our war won't end till our war ends.
Color. color, 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 color.
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday, you know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you going to do?
But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.
The next area that we're going to go over is defenses to crimes. Again, defenses to crimes. There are three main categories of defenses to crimes. Those three main categories of defenses are, number one, justification, number two, excuse, and number three, mitigation. Again, the three main categories of defenses to crimes are justification, excuse, and mitigation. So let's go over justification first. Justification, the general rule for justification is the defendant will not be held liable for conduct that is justified. A justified action is permitted for protective reasons. Once again, the rule for justification is a defendant will not be held liable for conduct that is justified. A justified action is permitted for protective reasons. There are five main types of justification. Let me go over those for you. Number one is necessity. Number two, self-defense. Number three, defense of others. Number four, prevention of crime. And number five, defense of property. I'll say those once again. Number one, necessity. Two, self-defense. Three, defense of others. Four, prevention of crime. Five, defense of property. Now let's go right into necessity. Necessity. The rule of law for necessity is a defendant may assert a defense of necessity when there would be a greater harm. So I'm going to give you an example. A, B, and C are rock climbing, and there's a horrific accident. A, B, and C are dangling from a rope. A and B are on the top, and the only way for A and B to be saved is for B to cut C off and let him go because the rope just cannot hold that weight. Out of necessity to save the two above, would B be justified in cutting the rope and letting and basically killing C? The answer to the question would be yes, because he had to kill one to save two. Once again, his defense would be he had to kill one. He had to cut the rope to save two. Therefore, that is the defense of necessity. The next one is self-defense. The rule of law is one is justified in using the amount of force which is reasonably necessary to prevent an attack. Again, self-defense, one is justified in using the amount of force that is reasonably necessary to prevent an attack. Deadly force under self-defense is only justified when there's a threat of serious bodily injury or death. Once again, you're only justified in using deadly force under self-defense when you are being threatened with serious bodily injury or death. There's a split between the common law and the modern law, and I want to go over that with you. Under the common law, which is the minority, required that the person try to attempt to retreat if they were able to before they used deadly force. Again, the common law, which is the minority, required an attempt to retreat, if able, before there was use of deadly force. The model penal code and the majority and what you want to use on the MBE is there's no need to retreat before using deadly force if there's a reasonable risk of death or serious injury, which is imminent. Again, under the model penal code, which is also the majority, and what you would want to use on the MBE portion of the bar exam, there's no need to retreat if there is a reasonable risk of death or injury is imminent. Number three, defense of others. The rule is one is justified to kill if another is in peril of death or injury. So basically, you're just coming to the rescue of another. It's the same basic rule for self-defense. You're justified in using the amount of force that is reasonable under the particular circumstances. So you would want to use a reasonable man standard, reasonable person standard. So there's a majority and a minority split here. I'm going to discuss that with you. The minority says that you step into the shoes of the person who you're defending. So let's say, for example, you come up into an alley and you see a guy holding a gun on another guy and you think he's being robbed. And you go and you attack the guy with the gun. Later to find out that that is a police officer arresting somebody. He's not mugging someone. He's actually a police officer that is arresting somebody. You just went and defended somebody who was being arrested. You attacked the police officer. The minority rule says you step into the shoes of the person you are defending. Therefore, in that particular circumstances, you would not be justified in going after the police officer. However, the majority and the MBE says that you are allowed a reasonable mistake. Again, for defense of others, you are allowed a reasonable mistake. Moving forward, number four under justification is prevention of a crime. And we have a split here. Under prevention of a crime, under common law, one was justified in using deadly force to stop the commission of a felony. Once again, under common law, one was justified to use deadly force to stop the commission of a felony. However, under the model penal code, which is also the majority and what I want you to use on the MBE, the rule of law limits deadly force to imminent public danger, and only the police, not an ordinary citizen, may use deadly force to prevent a crime. Once again, under the model penal code, the majority and the MBE, it limits deadly force to an imminent, meaning immediate, public danger, and only the police, not an ordinary citizen, can use deadly force to prevent a crime. So that is crime prevention. Number five is defense of property. The general rule to defense of property is you may never use deadly force to defend property, property of your own, property of another. Again, the defense of property general rule is no deadly force is allowed or justified to protect property. We do have one exception. That exception is when you are in your own home. You can protect yourself in your own home by using deadly force. Once again, the general rule for defense of property is deadly force is not justified to protect your property. The one exception is when you are in your own home and you want to look for a burglary. So that's the one time that you can use deadly force for defense of property. So once again, I'm going to just go over those quick five justifications to criminal conduct. The rule of law is the defendant will not be held liable for conduct that is justified for protective reasons. And the five justifications are necessity, self-defense, defense of others, prevention of crime, and defense of property. Moving on, the next category of defenses to crimes is excuses. So excuses to criminal conduct. There's basically eight types of excuses to criminal conduct. Those eight types are 1, insanity, 2, diminished capacity, 3, infancy, 4, intoxication, 5, mistake, 6, duress, 7, consent, and 8, entrapment. Once again, insanity, diminished capacity, infancy, intoxication, mistake, duress, consent, and entrapment. Now let's talk about the first one. The first one under excuses to criminal conduct, insanity, there are basically 4 theories of insanity. The 4 main theories of insanity that you're going to learn are, number 1 is called the McNaughton rule. Again, McNaughton rule. That is what's called the right or wrong test. Number 2, under the model penal code, it's called the substantial capacity test. So the model penal code rule is called the substantial capacity test. Number 3 is the irresistible impulse, basically the inability to control themselves. Again, irresistible impulse, which is the inability to control oneself. And the last one, number 4, is the Durham rule. Let's go into those and discuss them each individually. The McNaughton rule, which is the common law rule, it's also the majority and what you want to follow on the MBE portion of the bar exam. It's also known, again, as the right or wrong test. The rule states, at the time of the crime, defendant had a mental disease so that he did not understand the nature or quality of the act or did not know the act was wrong.
Our top story at this hour, a murder case in the state of Tennessee is garnering national attention. And the spotlight is a woman who was sentenced to 51 years in prison for killing her captor after he solicited her for sex when she was only 16. After several appeals, the state Supreme Court ruled Santoya Brown, now 23 years old, must serve 51 years behind bars before being eligible for release. This move quickly sparked outrage by supporters who say the ruling was unjust and her constitutional rights were violated. And recently, during a Nashville event where the Tennessee governor was speaking, a group of protesters demanded he consider offering her clemency.
And you might get parole after 51 years for a victim of sex trafficking.
Thank you very much for coming.
And so, well, I'm finishing my question, sir. I'm finished. Governor Asm's going to ask me when I finish. And so I asked, why has Santoya Brown been incarcerated for 14 years for enduring harm?
In the meantime, Brown's case has caught the attention of Hollywood stars like Rihanna and Kim Kardashian, who have encouraged others to sign a petition for her release. To date, 500,000 people have signed that petition on a moveon.org. For more on this, earlier today, I was joined by Dee Watkins, editor-at-large for Salon Magazine and author of We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. Many say this was an unjust sentence for a 16-year-old. Would you agree?
Not just for a 16-year-old, but for a 16-year-old who was captured and forced to have sex with people for money. What do you expect? A young woman in an abusive relationship who was captured, who thought her life was in danger, who probably thought her life was in danger at multiple times. Like, what do people expect?
Now, prosecutors were saying that this young woman went after this 43-year-old man so that she could rob him. And her case, Cynthia, was basically saying she did this because she had to, because she was in an abusive relationship, like you mentioned. But when it comes to this, let's say her intentions were to rob this man. Should a 16-year-old young woman, little girl, a teenager, have been sentenced to 51 years behind bars?
So one thing those prosecutors need to, you know, understand or think about is what were they doing at 16 years old? What was your mindset like? You know, were you in a situation when you were captured and being sold for sex? Or when you in school and having fun with your friends and, you know, applying for colleges and things like that? Like, we victim blame so much in this country. No one's asking, you know, and I don't think anyone should be murdered. I don't think anyone should be murdered, but no one's asking, why is this man, you know, bringing a 16-year-old woman and have sex with him? So that's not the conversation. And then we're also not having a conversation about the person who captured this young lady. We're just putting everything on her. And we have to understand that she could not have been in a normal state of mind when that happened, and she was a child. So it needs to be considered.
So, speaking of consideration, Tennessee's governor is considering Santoya's clemency request, but he says he has a lot of other cases that need to be reviewed. So should we just anticipate that this could probably take a while before we get an answer about this request?
Yeah, everything's political. Like, you know, a lot of politicians, they just play games because they don't have to live in these types of realities. They're fortunate enough to have the things that they have, whereas his daughter will probably never even understand the reality that this young lady went through. And again, you know, I'm not here to pass judgment on anybody, but what I will say is just think about what you were doing when you were 16 and think about if your life was like that.
So I'm sure you've been paying attention to the news, and since what, last year, celebrities like Rihanna, Kim Kardashian, they've been using their platform to protest against this life sentence for this young woman who won't be eligible for parole basically until 51 years from here. Do you think this type of pressure from celebrities can make a change, make a difference?
I think it does, because they have platform, and, you know, a lot of people, they don't really feel bad about some of the things they do, but they do feel bad when everyone knows what they're doing. So, you know, if we know you're the governor in a state, or you're, you know, a prosecutor over a case where something so egregious happened and you sit back and done nothing, and all of these different people are tweeting you and calling your office and signing petitions and fighting against it, it can put pressure on them to actually do what's right. Again, this is, we're talking about a woman who was 16 years old in a situation that was beyond this unimaginable.
Hey, YouTube. Thanks for checking out our channel.
So what happened to your hair?
You know, I cut my hair.
Why'd you do that?
Because I don't want to be pretty no more. Because it don't do nothing to cause you trouble. Think of what got me into this mess.
Yeah? What got you?
Being attractive. And what do you attract? Crazy people.
So, what do you see as similarities between all the different men who have been in your life, besides the fact that they're men? How are they similar? How are they different?
Selfish. That's what they're similar. They're all selfish. They do whatever they get, what they want, makes them happy. They don't think about others' happiness. And everything that they do, they feel they're justified. They don't ever accept fault. That's what my dad said. Said in his letter, he goes home and sleeps at night knowing that he did his best.
What did Johnny want from you?
Sex. For money. No. They all wanted acceptance and admiration. Hell yeah. That's what they wanted. My dad wanted to be admired because of the hard work he put in driving trucks and making that money and supplying us with the life that we lived. Cutthroat. He wanted to be admired by everyone else in the street because I remember that one time he said that I was going to work and get him this truck. It was a Suburban on some 26s. He wanted admiration. He wanted somebody to respect him. He wanted people to admire him. That's, oh my God. Then you got Johnny. What did he say? I want a woman to make love with me with desire. Remember I told you that part? Desire. He wants to be accepted. Hell yeah. And those are my problems.
How are they your problems?
Because I always want to be accepted. 18 years. That's part of the reason I cut my hair off and shaved my eyebrows off. It's kind of like to prove to myself that I'm beautiful without all that, you know what I mean? And I'm worth more than that.
And did you feel that?
Yeah. Every now and then I feel stupid for cutting all my hair off and shaving my eyebrows, but basically, yeah. I think I've been, for the past 2 years, working on making a personality. I've never had one before.